all that case.
The court will now call estate of William Allen Moncrief Jr., deceased. May it please the court, Mr. William L. Kirkman will argue for the appellants. Mr. William Boyce will argue for the appellees.
May it please the court. I want to answer your question first, Justice Wallach, in the context of Moncrief Partners. If you will look at page 39 of our brief, we make crystal clear, in my judgment, that the question of capacity and the question of undue influence was in fact raised at the arbitration proceeding or whatever with the letter writing campaign that began. I'll address that further in the argument, but I just wanted to make clear that point to the extent it is of interest to you in this appeal. Now, I believe that the Moncrief Partners decision can be analyzed under the exact same three-step analysis that Mr. Barton referred the court to. But before I get into that, I want to give the court sort of a very basic understanding of what I think are very important, undisputed facts that underline the Moncrief Partners dispute. Number one, the Moncrief Partners agreement was executed in 1995. It's in the record. The partnership was converted to a Delaware partnership in 1998. And at that time, the first amended and restated agreement was executed. When we got to that point, and by the way, Texas, the one who started this limited partnership, and initially in 95, owned 90%. 10% of that was owned by his son, Charlie. When we got to the conversion in 98, Tex owned 89%, Charlie 9%, and the rest 2% was owned by the general partners who were corporations. All of that is undisputed and in the record. Two important points about that restated partnership agreement, which is the partnership agreement at issue in the case. One, it undisputedly called for the ability of substituted partners to become partners in that partnership. 3.05, 8.01, 8.20, and 8.21 make that clear. Also, my worthy opponents have admitted that the management trust is in fact a limited partner. So that issue is number one in that partnership. Number two, it has a very, very broad arbitration clause. And I've made that as an attachment, I think it's number two to the handout that I gave you. For resolution of any dispute under this agreement, the party shall follow certain rules.
I have a question.
Sir.
The key language, any dispute under this agreement. Okay. First off, is there any disagreement that the third amended counterclaim was the live pleading that the court was working on?
I don't think so. I don't think there's any dispute as to that.
Okay. So what relief in that document would qualify as a dispute under this agreement?
Well, I'm not sure that's the relevant question. I mean, what's any
point? Humor.
I don't think I can hear, knowing you for as long as I have, I'm not sure I can humor you. But the question is really...
I normally got that question in the form of, wait, that's not the question I asked.
Well, I learned from being before you that I don't... that's not the way I shall approach it. But here's the issue. The any dispute under this agreement is, of course, the Moncrief Partners agreement. And what's critical is that is the subject of the arbitration, Judge Wallach. That is the container agreement. When you go back to the analysis of the facts, what happened was, after Dick and Marshall were appointed as the trustees under the management trust, they looked into the records of Moncrief Partners, they found something they didn't really understand or like, and they filed an arbitration. Because the Moncrief Partners Agreement called for arbitration. That's why they did that. So to get those disputes that they had over the Moncrief Partners issue resolved, they filed arbitration. Now, what I started this argument off was in response to that, my worthy opponent said, no, Dick and Marshall do not have the ability to enforce that because, why did they say it? Because under the management agreement, they were appointed trustees at a time they claimed Tex didn't have the capacity, was under duress. So they are the ones that raised that in the arbitration as a defense to going forward. And that is fundamentally critical to your analysis of this entire situation. Because it was after that that the litigation became active in the trial court with an attempt to stay or enjoin the arbitration.
So, you can bring me back to my original question, and I'll proceed into the next question. Is there anything in the appellee's pleadings in the trial court which would amount to a dispute under the Moncrief Family Partnership?
Well, the Moncrief Family Partnership is the subject of the previous appeal.
I understand that.
But yes, there was an issue raised in the trial court about who are the trustees of the Moncrief Family Partnership, but that is a subsidiary, irrelevant issue to this appeal, if I'm understanding your question. I mean, before the arbitrations arose, Judge Wallet, there were disputes as to who were the management trustees, no question. But that was before a dispute developed as to Moncrief Partners. And it is critical for this court to understand that that's what led to the arbitration, which is a separate and distinct issue that I think has to be controlled by the three-step analysis. We have the right to go to arbitration because of that, Brian.
I'm going to ask you a question about the arbitration. Okay.
Sure.
I want to focus on the pleadings in the probate court. In the appellee's pleadings in the probate court, were there any claims with respect to some breach of the Moncrief Family Partnership?
Well, I'm not sure of the Moncrief Family Partnership because that's not been the focus of this appeal. I'd have to go back and check. I don't know whether they raised any issue as to the family partnership in their pleadings in the trial court. What I know is there was a dispute, Judge Wallach, over the trustees of the management trust.
Wow, that's not what I'm asking.
Yeah, but I am just unfamiliar with that because I really haven't looked into that before this argument.
In particular, I'm talking about the First Amended and Restated Limited Partnership Agreement of Moncrief Partners LP, which is what you're...
Right.
Right. Was there any issue in the appellee's pleadings in the trial court with respect to some breach or disagreement about that document?
No, Moncrief Partners, no.
Okay.
You had raised Moncrief Family Partnership, which was a different agreement that I wasn't prepared to address. But no, absolutely not. Nothing raised in that. The focus of the litigation, Judge, was the trustees under the management trust for reasons that had nothing to do with the partnership.
I understand. What I'm trying to figure out is what is there in the appellee's pleadings of the trial court that would constitute and agreed a dispute with respect to the First Amended and Restated Limited Partnership Agreement of Moncrief Partners LP.
There was no pleading in the appellees. There was no challenge to that agreement. It wasn't even an issue in the litigation.
Okay, so now there's no dispute in the probate court litigation. How was that issue raised in the arbitration?
The way I started this entire argument off is, we filed a demand for arbitration to resolve the disputes we had under the Moncrief Partners Agreement. They responded and said...
When you say Moncrief Partners Agreement, what's the name of the agreement that we're talking about?
Moncrief Partners Limited Partnership Agreement, the restated agreement that is the subject of this appeal. What I'm trying to advise you is we filed that arbitration request, which we had a right to do. They wrote the AAA and said, stop. The question of Dick and Marshall's right to bring that, the right to enforce the Moncrief Partners Agreement, is a question because they claim that Dick and Marshall didn't have the ability to bring the claim because Tex didn't have the capacity or was under influence at the time Dick and Marshall were made successor trustees under the management trust. Stop. Then we end up in court to fight over that issue, which brings us to this appeal. So the Moncrief Partners Agreement, as opposed to the Family Partnership Agreement, had nothing to do whatsoever with that litigation. It was raised when we went to the demand arbitration because of the issues we found that out going on with Moncrief Partners. So what do you do? I am absolutely convinced that this El Paso case that you referred us to, combined with Baby Dolls and most recently the Gulf of Mexico case, put an exact perfect legal roadmap for you to decide this appeal under that three-step analysis. And quite frankly, it is much more direct, more straightforward than the Moncrief Family Partnership dispute that you've already resolved. Because remember, a big difference here is we're now talking about an ancillary agreement, that is the management trust, and who are the trustees there. In Moncrief Family Partnership, you had a question over who were actually the partners in Moncrief Family Partnership. So what do you do? How do you follow that Supreme Court law? Number one, look at the container agreement. What is the container agreement? There can be zero dispute here that the container agreement is the Moncrief Partners amended and restated partnership agreement, which is in the record, which is what I referenced first. There is zero, none, nada dispute over the formation, the validity, or anything about that agreement. They don't dispute the legitimacy of that agreement. They do not. So the first step is pretty basic. You got no dispute, the container agreement's there. We know from the Supreme Court's analysis that since the arbitration clause is within the container agreement, you got to use this separability document. I knew I was going to have trouble pronouncing it. So that's what you do, not the container agreement. So what then do you look to under the Supreme Court's direction? Well, how broad is that arbitration clause? What does it say? I suggest to you that when you clearly read that arbitration provision, you're not going to have any problem deciding that it is about as broad as you can get to cover any dispute that comes up over that partnership. Now, two other things I want to point out at this point. This agreement, remember when I said in 1998, they formed it under Delaware, it says specifically that Delaware law controls, okay? Well, Delaware law is pretty clear that when you have the specific provisions that this arbitration provision has, that is, incorporating the AAA rules, being so direct about what you do in procedures when you arbitrate, that means that it's clear from a reading of the agreement that the process of delegating those issues to an arbitrator is clear. Now,
is there any authority under Delaware law that customary capacity or the capacity to contract or undue influence is an arbitrability issue as opposed to a judicial issue?
Not in this context that we could find. Now, there's plenty of Delaware law that talks about reference to the AAA rules and making any dispute go into arbitration. And this is a dispute that they raise at the arbitration level. I can't emphasize it enough to answer to your question. So back to my point. Delaware law is pretty clear about what is it arbitrable. The Gulf of Mexico case basically says even if they didn't incorporate the AAA rules, if it's clear from the reading of it that it's a delegatable duty, it's the arbitrator's decision. So you got three strong cases that direct you to say, because that clause is so clear in its delegation, that the arbitration clause is where you go. Now, the last question, of course, when you look at the opinion is, what do you do with a challenge to the arbitration clause? They don't challenge the arbitration clause. They make this argument under the James case that, well, they're not signatories to the agreement. Well, I think the last time I was down here, I pointed out the language in the Rubiola case that actually was before the James case that talked about when you have specific provisions. My time is up, so I'll complete that on that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have a suggestion and a request, which is I can stand up here and tell you, no, we did not ask the AAA to decide the issue of capacity with respect to management trust. They said we did. We said we didn't. May I request leave to file a supplemental letter brief that will go through the correspondence relating to that, which I think will demonstrate to the court that we asked, we demanded that the AAA stand down and not decide the issue of capacity with respect to the management trust.
You want to file a supplemental brief or just a supplemental letter?
A supplemental letter.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. So I won't burn up a bunch of time with says me, says him. A couple of points. So there's a lot of terminology that gets thrown around here, and sometimes it's referred to as arbitrability, and it's easy to make reference to arbitrability. I want to be super clear about what our position is. Our position is that there is no agreement to arbitrate. That sometimes gets referred to as arbitrability, but what it really is a threshold question about whether or not there is an agreement to arbitrate, which is a court decision, and it's most especially a court decision when capacity to sign a contract is at issue. So,
do you agree that your clients are claiming their authority as successors to the original agreement that was created?
Yes, the amendments to the management trust are numerous and there, but I don't want to lose sight.
But that's basically is true under all these scenarios that we're seeing is text representing differing capacities, created agreements, and then the dispute between the parties are your folks are claiming as successors under one scenario and the other side is claiming as successors under another scenario.
Nobody is not a successor or claiming successor status, but here's the point. Just because successor status is claimed doesn't mean that you have it. That is a court determination when the underlying challenge is based on capacity under Morgan Stanley and other cases. Just because you say you're a successor doesn't mean you're a successor. And when the capacity to make the amendments that appoint this person or that person as successor is challenged, that's a court decision. So I don't want to lose sight of that fact. But look, I also want to be sure that I focus on the main points for this appeal. This will be somewhat reiterating what I said in the first argument, but that this appeal is not just the sequel of Moncrief 1. This is not just arbitration and see Moncrief 1. It doesn't work like that for the same reasons that we've already discussed. And so I want to put the court back, if I can, to the order that we're actually here addressing on appeal. This is the January order, and it's got the same limitations that the other order had. So I'm looking at the January order signed by Judge Allen. You look at the top of page 2. It grants the motion to strike intervention of Moncrief Partners and CVM Genpar. It grants the plea, not just the striking of the intervention, it says there's no jurisdiction with respect to those entities. And it dismisses Moncrief Partners and CVM Genpar. So the point here parallels the one that I made in the prior argument, which is the dispute over a company agreement or the so-called container agreement has been expressly carved out of this order. Let me say it a different way. Moncrief Partners and CBM Genpar are not parties to this appeal. And Gloria, Tom, and Gary are not parties to the arbitration. These are separate disputes. And this goes back to my point that it's not legally appropriate to just say glom everything together as the capacity undue influence dispute and say that suddenly an arbitrator gets to decide a capacity or undue influence dispute no matter what the circumstances are. So again, the probate court, by carving out the company dispute, narrowed the focus of this order. And the court did so for the exact same reason. I would direct the court, this court, to paragraph 8 of the January order, where the court again explains what it's doing and why. It is trying, the probate court is trying, and I think effectively accomplishes, the focus of this order solely on a dispute over who is the trustee of the management trust, who has authority to act on behalf of the management trust. Act by invoking arbitration, by making a distribution, by paying taxes, whatever, signing a contract, whatever it is. And Justice Birdwell, you highlighted the point about where this leads if Dick and Marshall's arguments get traction. So there are what now, 4 arbitrations pending, something like that, a couple of court cases. You know, are 4 different arbitration panels going to decide capacity or undue influence? What if they disagree? What if a subsequent court ruling disagrees? It's impractical. The orderly approach to this.
It also could be appropriate under the circumstances. If those decisions were made at different times and the evidence shows different capacities at different times.
With respect to different documents, there's that possibility. But there's also the possibility that different arbitrable decision makers can decide contradicting determinations about capacity on the same day for the same document. So again, we're stepping back here and trying to look at the big picture. The big picture involves the risk of conflicting determinations. It also involves the question, and I want to reiterate this again, that this is probate. This comes out of probate court, which is a different ballgame than the Moncrief One situation that came out of the district court, because it involves the exclusive jurisdiction of the probate court. And I want to underscore a point about the reach of that exclusive jurisdiction. I'm used to thinking of exclusive jurisdiction, sort of like reach out and grab jurisdiction, as the special probate authority or power that allows a probate court to act to the exclusion of other courts. That's the easiest way for me to understand it. But that concept is not limited to exclusion of other courts. And I have a particular case that I want to identify for the court that I don't believe has been cited in the briefing, but we identified it in our subsequent research. And that is In Re Ron, R-O-N, 582 Southwest 3rd, 486, at page 493. It's a mandamus proceeding out of the 14th Court of Appeals. That case, the Ron case, involved exclusive family law jurisdiction, not exclusive probate court jurisdiction. But I think the analogy and the analysis carries over here, where the Ron case recognized that was a case involving a settlement agreement with an arbitration provision in a hotly contested divorce. And some aspects of what was supposedly going to be arbitrated pertained to rights over the children, where they were going to live, those control over their decisions for their care, that are exclusively entrusted to a family law court. And the Court of Appeals recognized that when you get to the realm of exclusive jurisdiction, an arbitration order or an arbitration panel decision cannot intrude on jurisdiction that is exclusively assigned to a particular court. I think the parallel is the same here, and it goes back to the same reasons.
So exclusive jurisdiction always trumps arbitration? That's your position?
When an arbitration order purports to address a particular topic that is assigned exclusively to a court, then yes. Now, you may have a situation like the Iran court, the Iran case did, where some of the things that the arbitrators decided were not within exclusive jurisdiction. And that
capacity is exclusive to the public court.
I am saying that capacity as it relates to the will and the estate and the trust is exclusive to the probate court. I'm also saying that this, I think, is a complement to the discussion we've already had, that courts decide capacity challenge. I mean, Morgan Stanley, I'm not going to relate the point, but when it comes to...
Are you not excited or are you not effectively arguing that there are certain things that have to be decided by the courts in that particular one? I don't know if child custody, the best interest finding was something that would involve, but best interest, is that subject to arbitration, or is that something that is exclusively because of the courts being responsible for the best interest of children, that the courts have to make that decision, and that's not something that an arbitrator can make a decision as to what's in the best interest of the child?
I think the answer is yes. The specific dispute, I think, control was over who controls where the child lives. But you've articulated the broader concept there. And so, again, I want to try to take a step back because I'm kind of bouncing around from different ideas. Moncrief 1 does not control the disposition of this appeal, just as it does not control the disposition of the 0058 case, for two basic reasons. Number one is that the arbitration is deciding different issues from what the probate court has narrowed the focus of this order to. And then number two, that implicates the considerations that we just finished discussing regarding exclusive probate jurisdiction. But let's talk about the differences between what's being addressed in arbitration and what's being addressed in this order. If you go to Defendant's Exhibit 47, that's the arbitration in the Baker Marshall file. What is the scope of the arbitration fight? Dick and Marshall say that they want to obtain an audit or accounting of the flow of funds in and out of Moncrief Partners and remedy the financial wrongs of CPM Genpar, the general partner of the entity. Okay, that doesn't address management trust in any shape or form. And I go back to the point that I started with or referenced a little bit earlier, which is the arbitration and this order are addressing two different things. Arbitration is addressing Moncrief Partners and conduct of CPM Genpar. That's not addressed in any way, shape, or form by this January order. How do we know that? We know that because Moncrief Partners and CPM Genpar got struck from the probate case on the motion of Dick and Marshall. There's no company agreement to litigate. There's nobody to litigate the company agreement in the probate court because Moncrief Partners, the entity, and CPM Genpar got struck. So again, I go back to what I think was a key part of Moncrief 1, where the court indicated that what was being decided in the trial court in Moncrief 1 that it perceived that was the same dispute that was submitted to arbitration, not the situation here. And so, you know, we're still at the beginning stage. which is who has authority to act on behalf of Moncrief Partners? There's competing claims to who are the co-trustees, as Justice Wallach has explained, and that is a decision for the probate court to make. Once we know who can act on behalf of the management trust, then the issue can be addressed. Does whoever was the arbitration initiated by somebody who had authority to act on behalf of the management trust to do so? So I go back to this notion of orderly handling of this, and I think the probate court had a very clear idea about what it was doing and why. And I think that substantially narrows the field here, and I think it makes this a straightforward, I hope, a straightforward analysis. It's not just cut and paste Moncrief one onto this one. Are there other questions that I could answer for the court? If not, I will thank the court for the opportunity for leave to file the letter.
Tell me when you want to file.
May I say 10 days?
Thank you.
Thank you.
And before you begin, Mr. Kirkman, I assume you'll want to respond to that.
Good assumption.
Uh-huh. And when will your response?
10 days after that. The three-step analysis is what is important here. It's not a cut-and-paste job from Moncrief One, but Moncrief One did follow the law that was set out by the Supreme Court. Now, when you apply that three-step analysis to this case, I believe the decision is very straightforward. Moncrief Partners' agreement, the partnership agreements, the container agreement, appellees do not challenge the formation of that partnership agreement. Appellees do not challenge the validity of that agreement or the validity of the arbitration clause that is in the Moncrief Partners partnership agreement. Instead, what they do, justices, is they challenge a separate and distinct agreement, the management trust. Under the separability document, the challenge is a subsidiary issue that is to be decided by the arbitrators. That is what the arbitration clause directs be done. Even assuming the appellees challenge the arbitration clause, as Gulf of Mexico points out, the clause clearly and unmistakably delegates this dispute over the capacity and undue influence of the trustees of the over the text of the management trust to the arbitrators. Now, there is a very narrow issue in arbitration. That is, the capacity that we believe they raised when they tried to stop the arbitration is what is the capacity and the undue influence back surrounding text in October of 2020. That is the narrow issue. Judge, you raised the question of, well, what about this time, this time, and this time? Well, the reality is in the litigation, there are challenges to various different amendments and the will in the litigation, which is different times. The point is that this narrow time dispute under the management trust is what needs to be arbitrated. That's what they tried to stop the arbitration. That's why the judge stated that issue needs to be resolved by the arbitrators because that's what they want. They don't want to have an arbitration under Moncrief Partners agreement because they say Dick and Marshall didn't have the ability to enforce the partnership agreement because they say you are not authorized under the management trust as trustee to bring it because of the capacity.
I guess my concern, started in the original dissent, is that parties cannot give a trial court jurisdiction that can buy agreement. The court's jurisdiction is established by statute. So the parties can't say, okay, we're going to take this to you type of thing. This seems to be the flip of that, which is, can the parties agree to remove from the jurisdiction a matter that is specifically under statute assigned to the court to determine? And that's where I am with regard to this. And there are other issues. You cannot take a judgment against an incompetent individual. You can't get a settlement with regard to an incompetent individual with regard to a matter that, even in a district court, without a guardian ad litem being appointed by the court as the officer of the court. So that, from a historical and a statutory and constitutional standpoint, that's my concern. If, in fact, you can withdraw from the exclusive jurisdiction of the courts, this matter, somebody else might have to tell me that, I think. So, but that's what I'm looking at, is the historical context in which we find ourselves here.
Well, I think the simple issue is, in our view, is when they raised this issue to stop the arbitration, is did the agreement delegate that to the arbitrators? And remember, we're only talking about a narrow issue with regard to the capacity of Tex to appoint Dick and Marshall as successor trustees, because they say you can't arbitrate because of that. Well, isn't that an issue that the arbitration agreement specifically delegated to the arbitrators? And it's only over that management trust. I mean, you can't go forward in arbitration without it. Thank you.
Again, we appreciate your arguments. They've been helpful to the court. Sign an order allowing supplemental letter to be filed by appellees 10 days from today, and the appellant will have 10 days from the filing of the appellee letter on your responsive letter. The case has been submitted. Now, please go back to business.